Well, church, I am so glad to be back. I missed you all terribly. My family missed you. My kids missed you. Actually, my kids came to church a couple times while we were gone, and that was really because they said, look, we're going to church. We know that you're on sabbatical. You're not going to be there, but you're either going to take us or we're going to find a ride. And so we would bring them and drop them off, or my wife Piper would come and be with them. But I am so grateful for the gift that these past 9 weeks have been, this gift of sabbatical. If you're new here this morning, you have no idea what I'm talking about. My name is Vern Collins. I'm one of the pastors here on staff at Boone United Methodist, and I've taken the opportunity to unplug this summer, but now my family and I are back and just couldn't be more excited. I would like to say thank you to those who stepped in and filled the gap this summer, to Andy and to Ben, to our setup team and our hospitality team, to the Carlsons and the Raymonds and the Norrises and the Popes and everybody that just makes this a reality on Sunday morning. Andy said last week that I can take a sabbatical and we're okay, but if Cynthia or any of the rest of them take time away, we are sunk. So I'm just so grateful for the gift that was these folks being willing to step up. And I followed along this summer. I listened to the messages on iTunes, and it was awesome to listen to them, not because I wasn't worried about how things would go this summer, and that was a real gift. So it was awesome to be able to listen and just receive and to read along in Acts with you guys and to just be a part of the journey and not have any role in making it happen. That was just an incredible time. And so I spent really great time with family, and there's no way I can unpack sabbatical in the next, 3 minutes. It's going to be a process. And my hope is that you'll just continue to receive the benefit of it over the weeks and months and years to come. But I got to spend really great time with my family, which was like number one on the priority list. Number two on the priority list, 1A was, or 1B was spending great time with the Lord, and then number two was more time fishing, which I got to do this summer. So, which God blessed, I think, because I was doing the other things. It was a great summer of fishing. So, but I also wanted to read this summer. I read through Acts. I spent time in the Psalms and Proverbs, which was really cool to just read through both of those. Read the prayers and the worship that the early church used. That's really what the Psalms were used for in the early church. This is how they worshiped. This is how they prayed. And then Proverbs, such simple wisdom to hold my life up against and say, gosh, God's making a lot of promises here. How am I, in line with this, or where am I not? And I also read some ministry-related books. I didn't want to focus too much on that, but there's some things I want to, grow in and be challenged in and do better, so I read some of that. But also, I made it a point to just read a great story. I wanted to just get caught up in a story. And so I reread the Chronicles of Narnia this summer, which was just, fantastic. Like, I'd read them as a child and maybe several years ago, but not chronologically, not starting with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but with The Magician's Nephew, to see like how all of this came to be, and just read through this whole sweeping story. And it holds up. It was awesome as a child, but to read it as an adult and see like what C.S. Lewis is doing under the surface, that he's a masterful storyteller. And he's telling, this fantastical story, but he's also like laying this deeper truth in there. And it was, gosh, it was incredible. I know some of you, have books that you kind of go back to. I don't know, Ben used to read the Lord of the Rings trilogy every year, and that's like, man, you are taking on a lot by doing that. Or maybe some of you read Harry Potter, every year, or what? We love story, and we love to be invited into a great story, which is so appropriate for where we've been in the series in Acts, and then especially what we're talking about this morning. So I want to begin. Now that you're maybe thinking about your favorite author, your favorite book, let's shift that just a little bit. Now, I want to ask you a question and have you turn to two or three people sitting around you and share this. Now, if you are, for some of you this might be uncomfortable, it's okay. Everybody's doing it, right? So who is your favorite storyteller that you know? Not like your favorite, you know, movie director or your favorite author, but like your favorite person to listen to telling a story. You know, maybe that's a grandparent, maybe it's, you know, maybe if you have kids, like they're phenomenal storytellers. And there's a fine line between lying and telling a story, but, you know, maybe your kids are your favorite storytellers. Maybe it's a professor you've had. Just take like 90 seconds and turn to a couple people around you and say, hey, this is my favorite storyteller that I know, and this is why. And if you don't know them, introduce yourself, obviously. Just take like 90 seconds and do that, and then we'll come back together. All right, so like 20 or 30 more seconds, or if you're done. All right, so now I'd like you to do, here's what I'd like you to do. Maybe would like one or two or three of you be willing to stand up and share not who your favorite storyteller is, but what, you know, one of the people that you talked to shared with you. Who'd like to say, hey, this is Stephen, this is Stephen's favorite storyteller and why? Wow, crickets. Yes. Awesome. Thank you, Grace. Piper? Anybody else? Colette. Awesome. Right, you got drawn into another story. Right, right, it happens. So, one more. Vicky. Yes. Yes. Yeah, thank you for that. Tom Cottingham was one of the pillars of our church. Fantastic man. And you're right, phenomenal storyteller. And he wore coveralls everywhere he went. And I aspire to that. Like, that's, I want to be able to pull off, I just want to wear coveralls everywhere I go. I mean, he'd roll up to church in coveralls. You're like, yep, Tom's ready to work, right? I mean, that's what he was, you know, that's who he was. All right, so I know a lot of great storytellers. I live with five of them. Man, my kids can spin some yarns, but when I think about my life, woven into my childhood memory are stories that my grandfather told me. My grandfather, my mom's dad, our grandpa, we called him, was the greatest storyteller that I know. Part of this was because he was just brilliant. I mean, if he wanted to learn about something, he gave everything he had to learning about that thing, whether it was the history of the house he lived in, and he never lived in a house without a history, or whether it was the Civil War. You know, when he learned everything he could about the Civil War, he moved on to World War I, And so he would tell stories about things that really happened, but tell them in a way that was so engaging. I mean, just you were just drawn into these stories that that he was telling, and it was effortless. He would, you know, he would tell you while he was also teaching you how to do something, and just unbelievable. When I was in at Appalachian for one of my English projects, I interviewed him and got to hear the story of our family going all the way back to the Scottish clans, which was really cool. I never knew that about who we are as a family. And he talked about his childhood growing up in Richmond, Virginia, and he used to walk. He got to know Civil War veterans. Like, for many of us, we can't even connect those dots, but he walked past a home, a veterans home for Civil War soldiers, and got to know some of these veterans. And he talked about being there when they raised the flag at Iwo Jima and during World War II and what that was like. And then he would also tell kind of these scary stories, not like you know, gore, like bloody kind of stuff, but just stuff that as a 5 or 6 year old you couldn't sleep at night. His favorite character in these stories was Charlie. I don't know why it was Charlie, but Charlie lived in the woods near his house at Lake Norman, and then strangely enough, Charlie followed my grandfather to the home he had near Asheville. So when we, you know, would go visit him there, he's still telling stories about Charlie. I mean, it was real like Watchers in the Woods kind of stuff. It was really just unnerving as a kid. I still think about Charlie. But we're captivated by good stuff. I mean, that's the power of good story. You're so drawn in that you find yourself captivated by it. And we give inordinate amounts of our money and our time getting involved in stories that other people are telling. You know, whether it's the money you pay for your streaming accounts on Netflix or Hulu or whatever it is, or whether you have like, you know, half a billion cable channels and you watch 4 of them, like we want to make sure that we're not going to miss out on a story. Or maybe it's the you know, on average, like 2 hours a day that you spend on social media keeping up with other people's stories. And, you know, maybe you saw some of these posts at the beginning of the summer on your Facebook feed or wherever. Hey, I'm looking for ideas for summer reading. You know, what are your favorites? Go. And you hope that, you know, people list like the books that they're reading or that they've read so you have some. Or what's, you know, what series do I need to binge watch on Netflix? Because we don't ever want to just sit down and watch an episode at a time. Why would we not watch 6 seasons in one sitting? Well, you know, because the new one's coming out, we have to be ready. There's nothing, you know, wrong with kicking back and doing that. We've earned it, right? We work hard. Or you know, scrolling social media, we're just doing our part to keep up with friends and family, you know? Like, we want to know what's going on in their lives. Or as Christians, we want to be informed. What's going on in the world? What are the cool kids doing? You know, what are they listening to or watching? We, you know, please don't go there for your, you know, political wisdom, but whatever. We spend a lot of time looking at the stories that other people are telling. We give our time and our energy, our finances, our resources, because we want to follow a good story. And, you know, the ways that we're tethered to technology, like that's a whole other series for another day, but there's one thing I think that's concerning in that, and one question that comes to mind, and is are you giving your time and your energy and your resources to keeping up with the stories that other people are telling at the expense of the story God is calling you to live, and consequently, the story that you could be telling to people around you? Are we allowing ourselves to get so caught up in the stories that are happening around us that we are ignoring the story that God has invited us into through His Son Jesus, and ignoring the possibility that we could then share that story with other people? Have you become so consumed with other people's stories that you have begun to neglect your own story? You've begun to neglect telling that story. You've bought into the lie that you don't have a story to tell. Now, you know, maybe your argument is, hey, my life just isn't really that interesting. I really don't have an exciting story to tell. You know, for as long as I can remember, I just get up and do my thing, and the days just kind of keep rolling, and then a new week comes, and that's my life. Or, you know, maybe you feel like your story is just too painful to tell. you work hard to craft something that's presentable to other people. You don't really want to let them into the mess. Or maybe you are just plain bored with your story, and so you escape into other people's stories because you've lost sight of how God intends for your story to be something worth living and something worth sharing. You know, whether or not you feel like you tell your story, the reality is that you are telling a story. You are sharing with the world around you your story every day. In the things that you give your time to, in the things that you give your resources to, your attention to, you are telling a story to the world around you about what is important to you, what you value, what matters. And, you know, in the things that you post, you're at least presenting a story to the people that follow you. So you're already telling a story with your life. But I want to invite you this morning to consider the idea that you might be missing out on telling your best story, because you're passing up the opportunity to live into and tell the greatest story ever told. The story that God is writing in you and the story that God longs to write through you. Let's look at one of the church's greatest storytellers. This week for our summer reading, I hope you've been following along in Acts 24 through 26. But this morning, we'll be in Acts 26. What do you have the starting verse at as? Verse 4? 9? All right, I'm going to start with verse 4, and then we'll catch up at verse 9, just to give a little background. So this is Paul speaking to King Agrippa, and we'll get to that background in a moment. If you would, in honor of the reading of God's word, please stand with me. This is Paul speaking. He says, "The Jews know all the way I have lived ever since I was a child, from the beginning of my life in my own country and also in Jerusalem. They have known me for a long time and can testify, if they're willing, that according to the strictest sect of our religion, I lived as a Pharisee. And now it is because of my hope in what God has promised our fathers that I am on trial today. This is the promise our 12 tribes are hoping to see fulfilled as they earnestly serve God day and night. O King, it is because of this hope that the Jews are accusing me. Why should any of you consider it incredible that God raises the dead? I too was convinced that I ought to do all that was possible to oppose the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And that is just what I did in Jerusalem. On the authority of the chief priests, I put many of the saints in prison. And when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them. Many a time I went from one synagogue to another to have them punished. And I tried to force them to blaspheme. In my obsession against them, I even went to foreign cities to persecute them. On one of these journeys, I was going to Damascus with the authority and commission of the chief priest. About noon, O King, as I was on the road, I saw a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, blazing around me and my companions. We all fell to the ground, and I heard a voice saying to me in Aramaic, 'Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads,' and that simply means stop going against the grain, Paul. Then I asked, 'Who are you, Lord?' 'I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting,' the Lord replied. 'Now get up and stand on your feet. I have appeared to you to appoint you as a servant and as a witness of what you have seen of me and what I will show you. I will rescue you from your own people and from the Gentiles. I am sending you to them to open their eyes and turn them from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God, so that they may receive forgiveness of sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me.' So then, King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to the vision from heaven, first to those in Damascus, then to those in Jerusalem, and in all Judea, and to the Gentiles also. I preached that they should repent and turn to God and prove their repentance by their deeds. That is why the Jews seized me in the temple courts and tried to kill me. But I have had God's help to this very day, and so I stand here and testify to small and great alike. I am saying nothing beyond what the prophets and Moses said would happen, that the Christ would suffer, and as the first to rise from the dead, would proclaim light to his own people and to the Gentiles. At this point, Festus interrupted Paul's defense. "You are out of your mind, Paul," he shouted. "Your great learning is driving you insane." "I'm not insane, most excellent Festus," Paul replied. "But what I am saying is true and reasonable. The king is familiar with all these things, and I can speak freely to him. I am convinced that none of this has escaped his notice because it was not done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know you do." Then King Agrippa said to Paul, "Do you think that in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian?" Paul replied, "Short time or long, I pray, God, that not only you, but all who are listening to me today may become what I am, except for these chains." This is the word of God for us, the people of God. Thanks be to God. So when Andy shared last week, Paul was on trial before the Sanhedrin. That is the one of the religious sects, one of the religious, Jewish religious bodies. He was on trial before the Sanhedrin, and the leaders realized he was about to be killed, so they transferred him to the care of Roman governor Felix in Caesarea. Felix knew that Paul was a Roman citizen. He was also aware of the plot of some of the Jews to kill Paul. So after questioning Paul, he simply decided to just detain him, just to keep him imprisoned. For a couple of reasons. One, he didn't, want Paul to be killed. He didn't want the blood of a Roman citizen on his hands, like not, on his watch. But two, he was hoping, because he couldn't really find any fault in Paul, he was hoping that Paul would get tired of being in prison and say, "Look, you heard me talk about the money that I brought, like the offering that was given from churches for those who need it here or those who need it in Jerusalem. You heard me talk about that. How about I just slide some of that your way and, we can just call this done and I'll walk out the door." So Felix is hoping that he will somehow benefit from Paul's imprisonment. Paul's not biting on that. So for 2 years, Paul remains imprisoned. And then there's a changing of the guard. Felix is succeeded by Governor Festus. So now there's a new sheriff in town. The Jewish leaders come to Festus and say, "Hey, there's this guy imprisoned. He's a Roman citizen, but he's this guy Paul." They're coming now with new charges against him. Like somehow in 2 years, Paul has managed, while he's been in prison, to commit new crimes. I love N.T. Wright's take on it. He says, Paul is accused of everything from planning to destroy the temple to selling drugs to teenagers and failing to stop at red lights. Like, they've brought the stuff he was already doing, and then they've drummed up more stuff because they're just trying, they want this man because they want him killed. They want to put a stop to what he is doing. He is wreaking havoc in the eyes of the Jewish leaders. Festus is, you don't get to be a Roman governor, by being an idiot. So he's like, "Well, I probably shouldn't give Paul over to these guys." So he's kind of torn. He knows, again, Paul's a Roman citizen. He wants to find favor in the eyes of, the Jewish people whom he is charged with kind of keeping watch over. So he goes to Paul and says, "Hey, Paul, I have an idea. How about we go to Jerusalem and you can stand trial there?" Well, Paul wasn't born yesterday. He's like, "Absolutely not. That's a terrible idea because they're waiting to kill me. So how about this, Festus? How about you take me to Caesar and let me plead my case before him?" Like, Paul plays his trump card. He's got nothing left. He has pled his case before the Sanhedrin. He wore Governor Felix out. Now he has a new audience with Festus. And he's like, "Hey, you know what? Let's quit playing around. Just take me straight to the top." One, because he wants to be free, because this is inhibiting what God has called him to do. But two, because Paul wants to take advantage of another audience, the highest audience in the land that he can get, to have the ear of the Caesar and tell him the story of what God is doing through Jesus. Paul is compelled by the gospel. So King Herod Agrippa II, another person, and this is the great-grandson, he is in the lineage of King Herod, who caused so much trouble in Jesus' day. So King Agrippa II and his sister, might have been more than sister, Bernice, come to Caesarea, and Festus is like, hey, Agrippa, I got this guy. You should come and listen to him. Because now Paul has demanded that he go to Caesar. Well, Festus can't ignore that demand, but he also can't figure out what to write in this letter to Nero. And Nero is not a guy that you want to send a prisoner to and say, I don't really know what he's done wrong, but he requested an audience with you. Try him, but I'm not sure what you're trying him for. So he calls in Agrippa and says, you got to come and, you know, listen to this guy, and maybe you can help me figure out what I can't find any fault with him. He hasn't broken any of our laws, so you listen to him. Maybe you can figure out what's going on. So here we've picked up with now Paul has an audience with King Agrippa II, his sister wife, and Governor Festus, and, you know, all the other important people that are there. So do you see what's happening here? Paul is taking advantage of every door that God is opening for him to tell the story of what Jesus has done in his life and is doing in the world around them. Now, you might think, hey, awesome, but I don't feel like God is opening doors like that for me. You know, I haven't been in a place like that before. It's not that I don't want to share my faith, but where is God opening doors? Well, maybe it's not so much that God is literally opening doors for Paul. It's that Paul is simply taking advantage of the circumstances that he finds himself in and leveraging those on behalf of the kingdom. Whether it is the people that he's in jail with who choose to worship, whether it is taking advantage of the jailer who thought he had lost his quarry and is about to kill himself rather than you know, face the embarrassment of not doing his job, whether it's Paul going to him and saying, hey, don't kill yourself. We're here. Whether it is Jewish leaders, whether it is Roman leaders, Paul is simply taking advantage of the circumstances that he finds himself in to tell the story of who Jesus is and what Jesus has done and is doing in his life. Which calls us to question, where are we passing up opportunity to tell this story? Where are we passing up opportunity to share something hopeful with someone who needs to hear hope? Not to get in a debate or an argument about what's right or what's wrong. There may be a time for that, but more often than not, I believe that the people around us aren't looking to have a debate. They are desperate for hope. And if you consider yourself this morning a follower of Christ, that hope is yours to share. It is yours to live in and walk in, but it is not yours to keep for yourself. It's yours to share with the people around you. And maybe that means going so far as to, you know, somebody shares something with you and you say, gosh, I'm sorry to hear that. I'll be praying for you. That's great if you're really going to pray for that person. But what if instead of telling them, I will pray for you, you just say, hey, can I just pray for you right now? And you pray with them in that moment. Or maybe it's just taking the opportunity to actually listen to someone who feels like no one else in this world is listening to them. To encourage someone. To invite them to believe in who they are. Making an investment in the people around us. Being willing to tell the story. Being willing to tell your story. Now, you know, we call this giving testimony, sharing what God has done, you know, in our lives. And you think, all right, I would do it. If I were ever put on trial, I would not back down. I would tell the story of what God has done in my life. But gosh, you know what? I haven't been put on trial for my faith yet. Well, chances are you're not ever going to be. I mean, if you stay in this, you know, comfortable place that we get to call home, Chances are you are not ever going to be physically put on trial for your faith. One of the other fathers of the church, Peter, says in his first letter these words. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. He says, "In your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord." Gosh, that's another sermon for another day, right? But it begins there. In your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. That sounds a little different than giving testimony if you're put on trial for your faith. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. The hope that is not dictated or determined by your present circumstances. The hope that cannot be snuffed out or squelched. The hope that endures because it is rooted in something that is enduring. The hope that is present when things are going south in your life. The hope that is present when things are going well. The hope that sets you apart in the midst of fear and worry that is gripping our nation right now. And it doesn't mean that you don't see that things are wrong, but it means that you look at the things that are wrong and trust that those things are not going to have the final say. What is the reason that you have for that hope? There are people around you who are desperate to hear about that, who need a hope in their lives. Peter says, always be prepared to give an answer. Not just when you're on trial, not just when you are facing persecution, but always, every day, in your coming and your going. Are you prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have? You might think, but people aren't really watching me. People are watching. You have children, they are watching you. They want to see how you respond when things are difficult. They want to see how you respond when they do something that you've told them not to do. Which version of you are they going to get? The one who has hope that that irreplaceable thing that they broke doesn't really matter in the long run? Your friends are watching you. The people that follow you on social media are watching you. We are always on trial to an extent. The church right now is on trial in a way that it hasn't been in a long time. What kind of picture are you painting for the world around you of what it means to be loved by Christ? What are you presenting to the world around you? Does it have everything to do with what you should do and what you shouldn't do and who you should be and who you shouldn't be? Or are you offering something that's way more than that? That we can't boil this journey of faith or this idea that we are loved by God through Christ down to what's right and what's wrong. Maybe it's about not worrying so much about presenting this perfect picture of, you know what, the way that I live proves that I'm worthy of the love that God has for me. If we are so worried about presenting that kind of picture, I don't blame the world around us for not really wanting anything to do with Christianity. Until we are willing to say, you know what, I am never worthy of the love that God has for me. On my best day, I'm not worthy of that sacrifice that God gave in his son Jesus on the cross. In Revelation chapter 13, verse 8, talks about Jesus this way. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life belonging to the Lamb, that is Jesus, that was slain from the creation of the world. We can't mark that historically. Since before the foundation of the world, the Lamb who was slain meaning that there is no point in history that you can point to and say, that's when I was worthy of God's love. That's when God chose to love me. At that point in history, God has always loved you. Since before the creation of the world, he had in mind how he would rescue you. Maybe it means being willing to admit that you are weak. Maybe it means being willing to admit that you don't have it all together, that you are unlovable on most days, and yet God persists in his love for you. Maybe there are people around you who simply need to hear that story. Maybe it means being honest with our own stories. In verse 16, Paul says that Jesus told him, "Now get up and stand on your feet. I have appeared to you to appoint you as a servant and as a witness of what you have seen of me and what I will show you." Paul didn't wait until he had it all figured out before he began to tell this story. All he had to go on at that moment was the fact that there was this group of people that he was working really hard to try to persecute, to try to put a stop to, and then there was a blinding light, and then there was a voice, Jesus, telling him that he had work for him to do. That's all Paul had to go on. Paul had a beginning. That's it. An encounter with Jesus. He didn't wait until he had it all worked out theologically before he began to tell this story. Jesus says, what you have already seen and what I will show you. The more that we walk in this life with Jesus, the more that he will reveal to us about who he is. But we don't need to have the end of the story before we begin, because guess what? The end of the story has already been written. All we need is a beginning. Who do you know Jesus to be to you? Not what have you been told about Jesus, what have you heard about Jesus, but who do you know Jesus to be to you? That's a great place to start. That's a great story to tell. What's your beginning? What is that encounter with Jesus? And maybe for you, it wasn't a flash of light moment. Maybe it was. Maybe there was a radical shift. But maybe for you, it's just been kind of this unfolding story that you feel like you've always been a part of. There is merit to that story that tells something of the faithfulness of God and what it means and looks like to walk faithfully with God. So what's your beginning? What's that starting point? What's that encounter? Now, we have to be careful here, because I think for too long the church has looked at someone like Paul and said, gosh, that's an easy story to tell, right? I was miserable, I found Jesus, now my life is all full and happy. If anything, Jesus made Paul's life more miserable, first of all. Like, trouble really started for him after the blinding light and after Jesus set him on the task. In fact, if you go back to Acts 9, when Jesus is going to the one who will pray for Paul and the scales will fall from his eyes, the guy's like, oh, no, I know about that Paul. And he said, don't worry, I've chosen him. He has no idea how much he must suffer for my name. So this, like, picture of full and happy and, you know, nothing is ever wrong, great. Like, if that's the life that God has given you, bless you. That's not my life, right? And for a lot of people, that is not real life. Real life is like, this is super difficult. On my best day, this is really hard. And I don't have many best days. Like, I have a lot of the other side. You know, so are we so, like, trying to simplify the message that we're not even being honest with where Jesus meets us and what it means to try to live sacrificially and what it means to try to live surrendered to the one who gave his life for us? The second thing is this, that Paul didn't find Jesus. Like, Paul wasn't out looking for Jesus. Paul was out looking for Christians to put in jail so that then they could be killed. Jesus found Paul. That is the way that bridge always goes. The initiative always rests with God. Now, we might respond to it, yes, but the initiative is never ours. Jesus found you. Maybe you were looking, maybe you were searching. Maybe it was when you least expected it. As Andy said last week, Jesus arrested you right where you were, caught you off guard, and he's been messing your life up ever since. But when you consider what can happen when you share this story with other people, not so that they can say, wait, maybe I need to go look for Jesus, but to know, hey, Jesus is looking for them. Jesus is searching for them. Jesus means to find them where they are. And the other thing that's difficult is that to talk about experience like that is awfully subjective. Like, this is the experience that I had with Jesus. This is who I used to be. This is who I am now. That's not a terrible thing. But what is that experience rooted in? Right? For Paul, it's rooted in a deeper story. I love this. Paul never negates everything that he's learned up to that point about the story of starting with Abraham and Moses and the patriarchs. Like, all of it, Paul has realized, he's woken up to, hey, it's all led to this one thing. It's all led to God sending the Messiah, his son Jesus, so that we might have life. Everything points to that. You know, we often think of conversion or transformation as this, like, this moment where things change. I used to be this person, now I'm this person. Man, God has the power to do that, absolutely. But I don't wonder if maybe more often conversion is just about waking up. Like, in my life, I used to pursue these things that I thought would fill me and fulfill me in substance and in relationship. And for me, the waking up was just realizing, wait, I'm trying to be filled, and really there's only one place that I can find that. Or maybe for you, the waking up is, I pursued these things with passion, you know, like Paul. And maybe the waking up is God's just redirecting the passion. So maybe it's knowing enough of the story of the people around you, being in relationship with them, to be able to say, hey, this is who I understand you to be. And gosh, I wonder, what if all the while God is been trying to meet you in that thing? Or what if God has kept you just frustrated enough, you know, that you realize that there's something more? Maybe it's just about inviting people to wake up. And that's the thing that drives Paul. That's what he's trying to do. I just want to wake people up to this truth that I've experienced, this deeper truth that is part of a larger story. And the thing that compels Paul, two things. One, he understands that the work is God's. It's simply his job to present the story. That it's God who's going to change lives. And so I love that Paul looks at that room and says, you know, when he's questioned, and when Festus, like, stops him, it says he shouted, but he was... The Greek there, I mean, he was furious. He was like out of his mind, because now all of a sudden Festus is on trial and Agrippa is on trial and everybody there who is listening to Paul is on trial because they're forced to examine their own lives. So he yells, Paul, stop it. You're out of your mind. You've read too many books. And then, you know, Agrippa steps in. He says, all right, well, hold on. Paul, honestly, do you think that you're going to convince me to be a Christian in this short amount of time? And I love Paul's answer. Hey, short or long, like that's up to God. All I want is for all of you in this room, you King Agrippa, you Governor Festus, the greatest and the least, I just want all of you to know what I know. And then he adds it then, well, except for the chains. Like, I want you to know what I know, but not the chains. He knows that the work belongs to the Lord, and he knows that sometimes it is a slow process. My grandfather that I talked about, at the end of his life, when I went to visit him in the hospital, I had the opportunity to say to him, because I knew that he wasn't a Christian, but I knew that you know, that he knew that I was. Because we talked about it. We talked about, you know, my work in the church and what God was calling me to do. And I said to him, Grandpa, like, I know that your time now is short. And I'm sorry that we didn't have this conversation sooner, but you're so brilliant. And I looked up to you for so long. Do you think that maybe you'd be willing to consider that even now there's still more to your life? That Jesus loves you and he's been pursuing you all along. And he said, Gresham, it's my middle name, that's what he calls me. He said, Gresham, yeah, I think I'd be willing to consider that. Man, I wish I had told him sooner. Because then we could have shared that together. You know, all of us have regrets. We know we've missed opportunities. But every day in Christ is a new day. We're given that promise. So how are you using today and what has been placed in front of you? And the second thing that drove Paul is that he believed that the gospel was for everyone. Everyone. People like him and people as different from him as they could possibly be. The gospel is for everyone. If you're here this morning and you think, you know what, I've maybe heard about this stuff, but I'm just not there. This story is an invitation for you. If you've been walking with the Lord for decades, maybe it's time to recount your own story in a fresh way, to remind yourself of all that God has done in your life. So maybe this morning is a new beginning. We have the opportunity to approach God's table this morning, the table that Christ has set for us. Dietrich Bonhoeffer talks about table fellowship. He says there are kind of three types of table fellowship for the Christian. There's the common meal, which is what we share every time we're together, where we get to say, hey, God, all of this is from you. In fact, all of it's yours. You just choose to continue to bless us with it. And then there's the heavenly banquet, the wedding table that we are promised one day when it's all said and done and Christ returns. But then there's this table, Christ's table, where we get to break bread and we get to share the cup that Jesus shared with his disciples when he told them, this is my body broken for you. And this cup, this is the blood of a new covenant. This is a new way for you to believe, a new way for you to be in relationship with the one who loves you. And this is Christ's table. It's not Crossroads' table. It's not the Methodist Church's table. It's Christ's table. All are invited to this table. There is a seat for everyone at this table. Paul knew that, and Paul gave his life to make sure that people heard that, that the gospel is for everyone, the hope that in Jesus you can have a new start, that you can have a new story to tell.